We hear about recalls for a lot of different things, vehicles and toys and baby products and, of course, food, right? We hear recalls all the time. But there are two that really stood out in the past month. It had to do with food, but it was more of what got into the food that really kind of sparked our curiosity here on WICC. So you may remember a few weeks back, Trader Joe's had two cookie products that they were recalling because they were worried about potentially seeing rocks in the products. And now this week, we're talking about Nestle. Nestle had a small quantity of one type of a cookie product as well, this time with wood chips potentially found in the product. And the question is, how do these impurities even potentially end up in our products? But more importantly, things like rocks or wood chips, we're not really getting the correlation here. So I'm very delighted to have for the first time on the morning show, the Connecticut Department of Consumer Protection. Caitlin is here. Caitlin, I want to say your last name correctly. Is it Crasselt?
Crasselt.
See, I knew I'd say it wrong. Caitlin Crasselt is here with the Connecticut Department of Consumer Protection. And Caitlin, thank you for coming on the show. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having us. We're happy to be here and happy to answer your question.
Well, thank you. We appreciate it. And I want to, again, reiterate, and I'll do this throughout the show today, that the Connecticut Department of Consumer Protection has absolutely 110% nothing to do with these recalled items. We are specifically going to them because they're the professionals who at least understand how this industry works, and they can give us more of their professional outlook on what could have happened or how this could happen. So, Caitlin, let's start there. Rocks and wood chips, it kind of seems bizarre. I mean, I've heard of plastic or glass or fiber, material getting in, but this just didn't really make sense to any of us. How could those materials end up in food products?
Sure. Well, I think the place to start, and let me just back up for just a quick second and let your listeners know a little bit about our foods program, because some people haven't heard about that. So our foods within the Department of Consumer Protection, we have a food and standards division, and their job is to inspect retail and wholesale food manufacturers that operate and transport and store food in our state. So if the food is manufactured out of state, we don't have a lot to do with it until it gets here. And then once it gets here, there's always a chance that we may inspect it. If there is a recall, we're obviously on the look for that when we're doing our other routine inspections. And so that's just kind of a quick overview so your listeners know, what our foods team is doing. In terms of, how this could happen, I obviously can't speak to these two specific cases. What I can say is that the manufacturing and processing facilities are very complex, and they're taking in ingredients from a lot of different sources, and there's a lot of different steps in the process. And these manufacturing facilities may also be manufacturing multiple things at once. And so the chance that, an impurity could end up in a food, while not a huge chance, is a small chance. And if, someone comes across something that appears in their food, even a very, very small batch of that, say just a couple of people, they are going to take an abundance of caution and issue a recall for those products. The majority of the product probably doesn't have anything in it, but in order to ensure that the public is safe, they are going to recall that whole batch.
So when they say things like small quantity, that's what they're kind of referring to. Like, look, we know we made a few thousand boxes of this, but we do know that maybe two or three bars in somewhere in here could have been impacted. So you know what? Let's just not even take a chance. Let's avoid lawsuits and anybody getting hurt. Let's just say we're going to recall it because it's better safe than sorry, it sounds like.
Exactly, yes. And we work closely with our federal partners, the FDA, to deal with these recalls. And so a lot of times companies are really great. They want to preserve their reputation. They don't want consumers to be injured. And so they're more than willing to provide all of the information and stuff along the way that can help in issuing a recall. And so typically there's no issue with that. There's not, you know, businesses aren't trying to prevent us from seeing what's in their food or anything like that. You know, I do want to make that clear that, you know, it's not businesses intentionally doing this or anything like that. They are trying to preserve their reputation as well. And we take public health and safety very seriously. Obviously, that's our role as the Department of Consumer Protection. And so anything that we can do to assist in that process is what we're here for.
Okay, so Caitlin, reiterate for me if you don't mind. I'm sure I sound like a broken record, but I want to make sure I've got this answer correct. So something like a wood chip or like a rock kind of material, the reason it very well could at some point maybe end up in a food product is because where these products are being manufactured are probably also manufacturing plants that are making other things with those materials in it. Do I have that correct?
They're probably being manufactured in a food plant that is manufacturing a number of products. I don't know that any of these food plants are probably manufacturing rocks or wood chips, but they might be manufacturing a food product that contains fruit that came from an orchard where, you know, in the process of harvesting all the fruit, some wood chips from the tree made it into that batch and it just never got filtered out along the way.
Okay, that would be one example. So it's like, yeah. So they're only making like food products, basically. Like, so I want to make sure I've got the picture for our listeners, like have it in their mind. You've got a manufacturing plant that's only making food products. It's not like they're also making, you know, cribs or something like that. They're just making food products there. But the ingredients, the stuff that they're bringing in to create that final product, there could be impurities that were not filtered out before they all got mixed in. That's what you're saying. It's kind of like the pre-mixing part, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there are lots of regulations in place to try to prevent this, but it, you know, it's impossible to eliminate the chance entirely. Because this is, you know, humans are conducting this process every step of the way and we make mistakes and sometimes it happens. But there are regulations in place to recall these products and to try to prevent it every step of the way.
I mean, I have to be honest, Caitlin, when you put that image in my head, and I would imagine, you know, thinking about like a fruit product, for example, and the hundreds, if not thousands of products coming out, how you could miss one or two wood chips. I actually think that'd be probably very easy to do. I'm surprised there aren't more recalls when you put it that way.
Yeah. So just to give you a little bit of perspective here, and again, I can't speak to the specifics of these two recalls, but on average, there are about 3,000 food recalls every year. That's reported by the FDA and the USDA. So that would include meat and poultry with the USDA. And each year, the number and scope really fluctuates. There's not a real pattern to this. Obviously, we want to have as few as possible, but like I said, there's human error involved. One of the largest chunks of those recalls actually has nothing to do with impurities being in the product. It's typically products are recalled for mislabeling, so they're missing an allergen disclosure on the label or something like that, and those products would need to be recalled. So a small percentage of that average of 3,000 per year are actually impurities in the food. So it's pretty rare.
Okay. Caitlin Krassel is here, and she is with the Connecticut Department of Consumer Protection. We're talking about how recalls happen, how often they are, and how sometimes impurities can end up in your food. I was curious if we can look kind of more at Connecticut. When a recall is issued, Caitlin, what is sort of the protocol? Like, what does it look like to pull all the items from the shelves or warn people who already purchased those impacted products and need to get rid of them? Like, what do the steps look like for you? You hear from the FDA and you're like, okay, go. What does that process look like?
Yeah, absolutely. So we do work really closely with our federal partners. And, you know, if it's manufactured outside of the state of Connecticut, we follow their lead, which is great. We're lucky to have such great federal partners in this. So typically what happens is a person, a consumer becomes aware of, you know, they buy something and they become aware of an impurity in their food. You know, they're eating it or they open the package and something's there that's not supposed to be, which is unfortunate. And then they typically file a complaint. You know, then there's an investigation that follows to confirm that, you know, that that product was actually had an impurity in it, you know, and at what point in the process that may have happened. So the FDA and the USDA and local food programs, we assist with that, sort of confirm what may be happening. And so then what happens is they issue a voluntary recall if there is a safety concern. So the responsible company, the manufacturer, or the distributor, or the retailer, wherever the issue may have happened, is offered the opportunity to initiate a recall first. Typically, they do, in my experience, because, again, these companies care. They want to preserve their reputation, obviously, and they want to make sure that the products that they're selling are safe for public consumption with that in mind. So they typically comply and they issue a voluntary recall. And again, that can happen even if, you know, it's identified that only a very small percentage of a batch may have been impacted. And so they notify the regulatory agency of their decision and the specific details of the recall. So they'll include things like batch numbers, best by dates, things like that to help people identify the products. And they will let consumers know what they can do if a product they have purchased is being recalled. So sometimes that may be returning to the point of purchase. Sometimes it may be calling a customer service number and getting your money back that way. So they'll provide that information as well. They also develop a strategy that outlines the scope of the recall and the affected products and what they're going to do in order to carry out that recall. And they classify the level of risk, so in terms of the probability of severe injury or illness. I don't know all of the levels off the top of my head, but
no, that was pretty good. I mean, wow, I'm like, wow, she's got it down. Okay, that was a lot of great information. I was always kind of curious because I would think, you know, you've got to get that information out to, you know, the stores, but then you also have to get it out to the people who already bought those products and you know, are not obviously going to get them, but they already have them in their home. So it's like before they consume them. So I was always curious how that works.
Yep, they get the information out to the stores, and they obviously let us know, and we put out the word. But it's also really helpful when organizations like yours do recall information. So thank you for doing that. It's important that we get the word out when there is a recall, because like you said, people may have already purchased these products and have it in their home and may not know that there's a recall. And then obviously the stores are responsible for pulling those products from the shelf.
All right. Well, Caitlin, I had one more quick question for you before you go. Can I get like the department's perspective on some of the shortages we have seen in recent years? Do you believe we kind of need to do more to expand our manufacturing options in the country? I think about like the diaper shortages, even medication shortages we've had, and we're just relying on like it seems like three or four main like major manufacturers, and if one, you know, place shuts down, now all of a sudden that prompts, you know, this massive shortage, which, you know, like I keep thinking of the diaper shortage. That was a big problem.
Sure. Well, I'm certainly not qualified to opine on, you know, production lines and things like that and how these shortages might occur. What I can say is, you know, it's definitely an issue. I think we're all aware of that. And anything that we can do to help businesses in our state sort of shift gears when there is a shortage, we do try to help with that. So one thing that comes to mind is when there was a shortage of hand sanitizer and a lot of businesses shifted gears to start producing that, you know, we played a role in just inspecting facilities and, you know, anything that, again, that we can do to help with that. But as far as, you know, the broader country, I don't think I'm qualified to opine on that.
That's okay. That's all right. I think that also kind of answers even just the localized question, which is when we have shortages, mm-hmm. how do we respond and how does the department respond? But it's certainly a much bigger question than even beyond Connecticut, because, again, it impacts the whole nation. So, Caitlin, I really appreciate having you on the show, and I hope you'll come back because I think you've got some amazing perspective. I love knowing what the Department of Consumer Protection is all about and such great information. So thank you for sharing it.
Of course. Yeah, let's be in touch. We'd love to start maybe something regular with you.
That would be great. We would love that. Absolutely. Yeah. I know our listeners were very excited to have you on this week. So thank you again for your time.
Of course.
All right. Caitlin Cressel here, who again is the communications director over for the Connecticut Department of Consumer Protection right here on WICC. Did you know American and Canadian consumers hold more than $16 trillion of debt? And that could be mortgages, credit cards, personal lines of credit, home equity. It goes on and on. But, you know, debt doesn't always have to be a bad thing. However, a lot of people find that they're kind of falling behind on payments and they get overwhelmed with it. So they go to credit repair or debt relief companies because they claim they can help, and maybe they can. However, according to the Better Business Bureau, over 11,000 complaints and almost 900 negative reviews have been submitted to the BBB about these debt and credit assistance companies, revealing that they are misleading, sometimes can be fraudulent, among many other issues that they are finding. So we wanted Kristen Johnson to come on to talk about this in depth and help us to understand what are some things we should be looking out for, and maybe even if there have been local complaints, what those sound like. So Kristen, thank you for coming back on the show. Always appreciate having you. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. I'm a little overwhelmed with some of those stats, though. It seems like the Better Business Bureau is too. What's going on?
Yeah, we saw a pattern of complaint in this industry. So we went back and we looked from June of 2020 to June of this year. And you just gave the stats, about 12,000 complaints, 1,000 negative reviews, over 1,600 scam tracker reports across the country. Here in Connecticut, we saw in that same time period over 100 complaints, over a dozen scam tracker reports. People who paid money to companies that promised they would either relieve their debt, consolidate their loans, fix their credit reports, and in the end, did none of that. And these people who are already financially vulnerable found themselves in even more debt.
And this sounds like a dumb question, Kristen, but they're paying for these services, right? So they're paying someone to help them get out of financial trouble, and they just wasted more money, essentially.
They did, because in a lot of cases, they could have just done it themselves. And we can talk a little bit about some of the options you have to rectify the situation. But they did pay fees to a middleman, to a third party to do this. And a lot of people may not realize that since 2010, it's actually illegal for these credit repair companies to charge an advance fee. So what I mean by that is that they will negotiate, or say they're going to negotiate, with the creditors on your behalf, but you have to pay them a fee first. Well, in reality, what the law says is that until they've made a settlement with that company and you've made your first payment, they cannot charge you a service fee.
Yeah,
so people don't realize that.
I didn't know that, because, you know, like when you go to see a lawyer to make your will or something, before they have you sign the documents, you're going to pay them to sit down and discuss what that will is going to look like. You know what I mean? So I think naturally people are going to think, oh, OK, if you're going to do all this work for me, that's fantastic. Let me pay you up front. But there's a law against. I didn't know that. That's good to know.
There is. And so what we've seen are legitimate companies who, unfortunately, are entering into these deceptive practices, and then all-out scammers who just take your money, who you are paying bimonthly or weekly, and in the end, they're not paying down your debt at all. You're giving them all your money, and you still owe all this money to your creditor, and now you're actually being charged late fees because you thought that your debt was being paid down, but those payments were just going to a scammer.
That's unbelievable. So we have Kristen Johnson here. We're talking about these credit repair, debt relief companies, and not all of them are scammers. I want to make sure that's very clear. We're not just talking about scams here, but we are talking about people taking advantage of you when you're already in a very vulnerable situation with your money and not coming through with maybe the promises that they said they were going to, and you end up being more in the hole than you wanted to. So Kristen, let's talk about, if you don't mind, you said there are resources people can go to and they don't even realize it, instead of going to one of these help companies, if you will. Where should people go? Like, what are some resources people should be going to if they find that their debt has gotten out of control and they want some help with it?
So you should call your creditor. Call them directly and try to work out a plan with them. Now, if it's a situation where you've had a missed payment, that automatically comes off after 7 years. There's nothing any company can do to make that happen faster. So if they promise they will, that's a red flag. But if it's a matter of just feeling like you're drowning in debt, you can take it upon yourself to reach out and try to figure it out. And these companies aren't going to be able to do anything more than what you can do yourself. So that's the first tip. If it's a matter of your, if you look at your credit report, first of all, you can get a free credit report. You do not have to pay someone. So you go to the FTC and they will walk you through how to get your credit report. If you see a mistake on it, there are companies that will charge you to fix those mistakes. You do that yourself by just contacting the credit bureaus and working with them to get those mistakes taken off. But definitely you want to research. If you just feel like you're just at a point where you need that third party, you need that help, research the lender first. Go to BBB.org, read their business profiles. Go to the FTC also. They can help you, point you to reputable people that can help you as well. But definitely call your debt holders yourself and don't pay an advance fee. Someone says that they're going to charge a service fee. That is a red flag. Another red flag to watch out for are these promises of being able to fix your or repair your credit in months. This takes years. If anyone gives you the promise of a fast fix, that is an empty promise and it will not happen. And you're just going to end up in further debt by paying these people who aren't going to fix your credit, unfortunately. And you'll still have all of that debt that you have to pay.
So we have Kristen Johnson here with the Better Business Bureau, and Kristen is talking about these credit repair and debt relief companies that claim they're going to help you when you're just well over your head in debt and you want to help manage the situation and kind of rectify it and just get on a better foot forward, when in fact they let you down immensely. And, you know, we didn't really talk about the scamming end of this, Kristen, but not to, you know, kind of throw you in the hot seat. Have you had any locals reach out to you with an example of being scammed by one of these, like just flat out scam? Or are we mostly seeing where people were just like there was deceit?
Oh, I've seen several. I'll give you a couple of examples. There was a woman I spoke to this week. She moved out of Connecticut 2 years ago. She had reached out to a company that her brother used back in 2020. He didn't realize he was being scammed at the time. She only lost $900, but in order to fix her credit, she had to fill out a bunch of paperwork. And so she handed over not only her social security number, not only her banking information, but she handed over all of her passwords. And this person told her that they needed that information in order to go into their Experian account and fix her credit report. So 2 years later, she moves out of Connecticut. She can't open a bank account because she's on some list. Her social security number has been stolen. It's on the black market. She can't get into her email anymore. Her email password is now stolen and being used. She can't get into her Experian account. She had just recently had to get another debit card because that was stolen. So this is now several years removed that she's still feeling the impact of her personal information being stolen. So that's one example. Talked to another woman this morning. Credit cards were taken out in her name by someone she knows. And randomly, she got a call asking if she needed help in fixing the situation. And she did. To this day, she does not know how this person got her information, how they knew that she actually did need help. She ended up paying $8,700. The company got a lawyer involved. So it seemed legit. And then all of a sudden, her online portal disappeared. You can't get a hold of these people. You try to schedule an appointment. It says there's not one available for the next year. I looked up the company on BBB. It's called Litigation Practice Group. They actually have been the subject of several alerts by Better Business Bureau, including an advertising investigation, and they went out of business. They have informed us that they've gone out of business. They filed
for
bankruptcy.
Oh, how convenient for them.
Mm. Yeah, and this woman's out $8,700.
Right, she's not going to get that money back.
Oh, yeah, God. Just in the last 3 years, 1,237 complaints.
Wow.
In the last 3 years against this company.
So then in that situation, Kristen, I know that you were giving us some tips on what we can do instead of going to one of these companies. But if you feel you need a company to step in, you need that middleman to step in and help you, how do you avoid situations like what you just said? What do you suggest people do? Obviously, research, but what else?
Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you will have to give up some of your personal information. So you, before you do that, you want to make sure that it's a reputable company. You have to look at customer reviews. I mean, that is so important. You look at the complaints. If you had looked up this company, you would see they're not reputable and you would not want to go with them. But the number one tip is really do your research or do it yourself. And once you do sign with a company, check your monthly bank statements. Make sure you're not getting recurring charges from companies, especially ones that you haven't actually entered into an agreement with. Don't feel rushed. Scammers and even unscrupulous businesses tend to use high-pressure tactics. So if you feel like you're being pressured to make a decision, take a step back. Look for someone else.
So there's just some really good things to be thinking about. And Kristen, of course, if people want to read the entire study and the information that the BBB has been putting together, they can always go to the website, bbb.org. And something else of note, just because we only have a certain amount of complaints that have come in or documented, scam alerts, things like that, would you agree that there's probably many that were just undetected or just not reported?
Oh, for sure, for sure. According to the Justice Department, only 15% of people who've lost money to a scam report it. So we know that scams are very much underreported. But we encourage you to go to bbb.org/scamtracker and fill out a report anonymously. That way we can educate the public and let them know that this is happening. And if you feel like you have been either a victim of a scam or even of a legitimate business and you want to file a complaint, go to bbb.org, file that complaint. Because once we see a pattern of complaint, we can take action. We can even bring that information to the Attorney General's office so that they can take real action against these companies and stop these deceptive business practices.
Yeah, certainly. And Kristen Johnson, always appreciate that you give us the scoop. Thank you so, so much. And I'm sure we'll talk again soon.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too. Kristen Johnson, Better Business Bureau, serving Connecticut right here on WICC. The website, bbb.org/scamtracker.
He's our fiscal watchdog. Connecticut State Comptroller Sean Scanlon joins Melissa in the morning now on WICC 600 AM. 107.3 FM.
And we've been keeping tabs with the comptroller, especially about MyCT Savings. He's been going all over the state letting people know about it. And he has an update actually for us from this week and some of the numbers, how many businesses have enrolled. So we've got Comptroller Scanlon here right now with the latest. Hey, Sean, how are you?
Good morning. Doing good. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you so much. It looks like, if I'm reading this correctly, as of Tuesday, you have over 4,800 businesses enrolled. Is that correct?
Yeah, we're up to 4,900, actually. You know, we're adding dozens of businesses each day as we get closer. 2 weeks to go until our deadline of enrollment on August 31st. And it's just been great to see more and more businesses signing up each and every day.
Now, I noticed that you were really, especially around the Fairfield County area this week in particular. Sean, can you tell us where you went and what are these conversations that you're having with business owners?
Yeah, you know, I love to travel around the state and talk to folks, not just about MyCT Savings, but just to hear what's going on and what's important to people and especially to our business owners, because I think everyone in Connecticut knows we got to do more to grow our economy and create jobs. And we've been doing a good job of that lately, but we can always do better in the state. And I always want to hear how we can help with that. But of course, I'm also talking to them about MyCT Savings. And so I was in Norwalk on Monday in a boxing gym at a ninja studio. And then yesterday was in Fairfield, the downtown area there. And, you know, what I hear always from people is that signing up for this program is really easy, that their employees are grateful to have access to a retirement account. And a lot of the business owners, you know, I was at a little cafe diner in Norwalk, and the guy said to me, you know, it's really hard to recruit and retain servers these days because, you know, there's a lot of competition. And as soon as I offer retirement, it made things a little bit easier for me to keep the staff that I have here. So
wow,
always great to hear stuff like that. And it's why I'm out there promoting this thing, because I really do believe this program is going to help guys like that and businesses all across the state.
Now, Comptroller Scanlon, I know that this probably seems very late in the game to ask this question, but we still have 2 weeks and there may be people who don't really understand what MyCT Savings is. Can you explain the program?
Yeah, basically it's really simple. It's a way for us to help you help your employees at no cost to you. So essentially, half of the workers in Connecticut don't get offered a retirement plan at their job. And that's not because they don't want to offer one. It's most of the time because they can't afford it. And I've seen that firsthand. When I was growing up, my mom ran a small business. She would have loved to offer retirement to her employees. She just could never afford it. And I hear that a lot from people. It's that, you know, maybe they offered a 401k, they did a match, but the fees that the business is paying is just too much for them to deal with all the other costs they have to run a business. And so where My CD Savings is helpful to these businesses is that we offer a Roth IRA retirement account to their employees, and the business does not pay anything for that. The employee pays a very modest fee as part of their investments, but the business owner does not pay anything. And it takes about 10 minutes to sign up for it. And then they've given access to retirement to their employees. And right now, as you mentioned, you know, we're closing in on 5,000 businesses enrolled across the state, which has far exceeded our expectations. And I think a really big sign that people really like this and they want to see it happen.
So really quickly, when you say a modest fee, and of course that's going to vary depending on what the job is, what are we looking at? What do we mean by that?
It's you know, a small percentage of whatever they're, you know, it depends on what they're investing, right? So the minimum contribution to be a part of this plan is 3%, but it goes all the way up to however high you want it, right, in terms of what you're contributing. And so I think pennies on the dollar is a fair way of explaining the fees associated with this. But again, I think people understand that, right? I mean, nobody does anything for free. My grandfather used to say there's no such thing as a free lunch. So, you know, everyone's got to contribute a little bit towards this to make sure that this program works. But it's not a big burden on the employee. And more importantly than anything else, the employer is not paying anything for it.
Okay. Now, is this required for businesses to be in My CT Savings?
No. So the law requires them to offer a retirement plan.
Okay.
So what's happening right now, and if you're listening out there and you own a business with five or more employees and you haven't engaged with us yet, you just have to go to myctsavings.com and either tell us by August 31st that you offer a retirement plan. If you do, you're exempt from the law. If you don't, you have to enroll in My CD Savings. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be a part of it, because what happens is if you have five employees, you have to work with us. We have to give them the tool, meaning we create the account for them, but nobody's forcing them to do this. And so, you know, right now we have about an 82% participation rate, meaning when we create the accounts, 82% of the people are actually going to stick with it and contribute. But that also means that 18% of people are opting out of it. If it's not for them and they don't want to save or they find another way to do it, that's fine. At the end of the day, all I care about is making sure everyone's got access to a retirement account. And if it's a business doing it or if it's us doing it, I don't care. I just want people to have more financial security when they get older here in Connecticut.
All right. So we have Comptroller Sean Scanlon here. And last month, actually, Sean, you announced that over 11,000 businesses have started in Connecticut and or hit five or more employees since December of 2022. And as a result, those businesses were then notified of the My CT Savings deadline, which, again, is coming up in just 2 weeks. What is the website if people want to learn more information, if they need to sign up or they need to opt out? You know, what is the website and what is the penalty if they go past the August 31st deadline?
So the website is mycdsavings.com. It's really easy. I encourage you to check it out. But let me just go back for a second, Melissa, and talk about how this is a really good problem to have, right? For the first time in a long time, Connecticut is growing businesses and growing jobs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the first 6 months of this year, we gained 14,000 jobs. That's the highest amount of jobs created in a six-month period of time in Connecticut in a pre-pandemic year since 2006. I was in college in 2006. So this is a long time ago. And I think that that's really welcome news. Yesterday, we saw an announcement that in July, we created 2,900 jobs here in the state of Connecticut. So a lot of job growth happening for the first time in a while in Connecticut, a lot of businesses being started, and we're sort of going back to these folks now for the first time and telling them about this program while also still trying to talk to the folks that have been in business for a while to remind them of this August 31st deadline. To the penalties, look, I right now have the power to take businesses to court that don't comply. I've said on your show, I've said very publicly, I'm not doing that. That's mm-hmm. stupid. I'm not taking small businesses to court. And so right now, my team and I, for the last 8 months, we've been focused every single day on just speaking positively about this, me getting out there and personally selling this program, and just trying to get as many people signed up for it as possible before this deadline. And like I said, we're closing in on 5,000. I think that that's a really big accomplishment, considering that the day I took office in January, we had 876. And with 5,000 businesses, we're helping tens of thousands of employees in Connecticut. And I just think that that's a good thing. And that's what we're focused on.
All right. Well, Comptroller Scanlon, one more time with that website. And certainly if people want more information.
MyCTSavings.com. Obviously, we're in the last 2 weeks here, so a lot of people are calling. A lot of people are trying to chat with us about this, as happens with any deadline. So ask people to be patient. We will get back to you. If you're having issues and you can't get through, you can always reach out to me directly. I'm a pretty easy guy to find on social media or on the phone or the website as the state controller. And I like to talk to people. So if you're having issues, if you're having problems, reach out to me personally. I'll get you connected with the right folks, and we'll get your team signed up for this.
All right. Comptroller Sean Scanlon, I thank you so much for checking in. And I'm sure we'll check in actually again. We should by the end of the deadline see what the total number was. That'd be great.
Let's do it.
All right.
Thanks, Melissa.
Sounds good. Comptroller Sean Scanlon here on WICC.